We have new Stygia today.
Not only do we have new Stygia, it's a very fundamental inquiry.
So it's philosophically rich, and it's very foundational just for understanding the halacha's basis, or the halachic basis for not just social organization, but how societies could fund or absorb the costs of the collective projects that they undertake, right? That's why I said in the WhatsApp that this is comparable to a taxation question. But we live in a very robust society, and the United States undertakes certain projects. Those projects are really expensive. It has to fund those projects. Now, I don't think anybody in the room would rather live in a third world country that doesn't have the infrastructure or the public goods or the benefits that we have living in a wealthy society. Anybody disagree? Maybe somebody disagrees. Maybe our leader will disagree. But otherwise, there are certain benefits to having the infrastructure of a wealthy country, but those things have to be funded. So how do you fund those things? You fund them usually through some sort of tax, by imposing the costs on the constituents. Then there's a further question about what's a fair way of distributing the tax. And here economists or moral theorists could disagree. Should everybody pay a flat tax? And everybody pay a certain amount of money, right? Which some people think is fair. Should there be what's the technical term for
a progressive
tax where you pay a higher rate if you're wealthier? Should it be a head tax? Should it be a property tax? Is it a wealth tax? There are all these different. Is it a sales tax? There are all these different ways of raising those goods. The halacha is good to weigh in, I think, on... So these are two separate questions. So one is the legitimacy of taxation, meaning the fact of taxing people against their will to cover the costs of these public goods. And then there's a second question about how to distribute. How do you distribute the tax across the different constituents in a fair way? Everybody see how those are two separate questions? Yeah. Anybody here have a problem, or anybody here think that taxation in general is problematic? How, like a chutzpah, that the government should come in and take a bite out of my paycheck? Benji, you're in that camp?
Well, you can't, like, if you hold by your rate, then you can't have any objection to taxation.
Yeah, good. So I'm going to flesh that out a little bit more, Benji. Great point. Usually the objection against taxation comes from I didn't agree to pay for these services. So there's no contract. And Benji's pointing out if the halacha has this rich conception of yored, that we don't need contracts in general to charge you, then for similar reasons, you shouldn't have such an objection to paying for public goods. I think that's a great point, Benji. Salty?
I mean, there's certain, like, not everything that's going towards taxes is going to end up servicing you. Like, for example, we don't use public schools, we have to use our tax bill for that. So, like,
yeah, it's the classic orthodox complaint, right? Why am I paying taxes for public schools?
Paying taxes for the public schools.
No. Right. You wouldn't. You would or wouldn't?
I wouldn't.
Even though you're not benefiting.
Even though I'm not benefiting from that thing benefits society at all.
Okay, good. So then you are benefiting.
Not personally.
Yeah. Well, so the argument is you are benefiting because it's good for you overall to live in an educated society.
I'm indirectly benefiting from what I say. It's not like a...
Well, I mean, do you benefit when your neighbors are literate and numerate and well-educated?
Do I? Yeah.
So economists call those things neighborhood effects, where actually, yes, just like you, it's better to live in a rich neighborhood. Arguably, it's better to live in a stable, economically stable neighborhood than an economically depressed neighborhood. It's better to live in a place where your kids are friends with people who are educated, and because it's a high tide lifts all boats. So it just raises the caliber of living for everyone.
Not as great of an advantage, too. I mean, if I'm the only literate person,
it'll be ripping everybody off, right? Yes. Right, you'll be the only one to fly to Mars while everybody else will be... You'll do everything solo.
I'm the only one in the car, maybe.
It's Like, it usually takes a neighborhood, right? It takes a neighborhood to build things and be productive. No, I don't. Where do you live?
Tina.
Where do you plan on living once you... We know not Israel until... Before retirement, you'll make your way to Israel. But you have your sights on a community?
Not any particular one.
Okay. Were they the communities that Ray Weider picked out in his Sichas Musar? I could say probably.
Possibly.
But you're not moving to the South Bronx?
No.
Okay. Why not? You'll have an education...
Jewish community there.
What?
Is there a Jewish community there?
You could start one.
If there is one,
there's
potential, yes.
I mean, okay. It's an argument, but I think the counter-argument is what economists call neighborhood effects, that we all gain by the level of education of the people around us being adequate. And I mean, and I'm not even talking about the crime that correlates to people not having good public schools, right? You want to live in a community where there isn't crazy gun violence, no? And if that correlates to education, then you gain by there being a good public school system. Yeah?
Well, I'm willing to bet if I find this like a service that the government does that don't necessarily benefit from.
Okay. We could fill the board with those types of things. But I want to explain how we got here. Benji made the point about Yored. I want to distinguish between two different ways of explaining what Benji said. I think you took it in the sense, well, if I'm benefiting, I have to pay. So the thing that justifies taxation is that I'm receiving a benefit. Another way of taking Benji's point is that in the same way that the halacha doesn't require a contract for your aid to be liable for your aid, so too there are other things that you could be liable for even though you didn't contract the service. But not necessarily that the justification of taxation in halacha is going to be grounded in Yored, i.e. you're receiving a benefit.
Right, I agree with that.
Okay. So then the question is there justification for you having to pay or you having to bear the cost even if you're not receiving a benefit from it? Right? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Romy?
Can the second part of the mission really be framed in terms of Yored, though?
No.
No. And you wouldn't get it from Benji's sentence.
Correct. Benji's sentence, I think, was just saying, if the criticism of taxation is that you didn't contract for it, then we know that halacha doesn't require you to contract things in general to be paid.
No, but that's actually, so I meant the other thing. I mean, halacha doesn't require it because the contract for benefit you receive.
So then we have to see, are there other things for which you don't require a contract for? Right, that fall into a similar camp as your raid, where you're liable to pay, even though you're not receiving any benefit.
Right.
Right?
But you're saying you could take two things away from your raid then?
Correct. Yeah, either of those, right? Either you'll say, oh, benefit, or just at least to help us move us away from the idea that everything has to be agreed to. Okay? Okay. And then number two, the second question is, how to distribute it? What's the fair way of distributing the costs on, or imposing the costs on everybody? And we'll see in our sugya, the Gemara actually takes a stand on that. What are some of the things in the Gemara that take a stand on this? Fair ways of, yeah, Eitan?
You live there.
Well,
there?
Yeah. So based off residence, are you residing there? What else?
Time.
Well,
time.
Maybe time. Maybe something that's a little out of that picture. How far you guys got in the Gemara?
Like, if you shut off mamon, how rich you are, hunch. Maybe yeah. Rich you are, maybe how much property you have there.
Yeah, lefi mamon, is it based off like how much wealth you have versus what?
Lefi nefashos, just per person.
Yeah, maybe per person. Right? So should households with greater numbers, greater sets of numbers, should they have to pay more in this tax? Right? Reasonable? In America, it's the opposite, right? You get a discount based off like the number of children you have in your family. But maybe the opposite should be true. Maybe you should have to pay a higher tax based off how many kids you have because you're using more of the public goods. Right? So good, that's another way of distributing it. What else do we find in the Gemara? And of course, we'll be mamon based on how wealthy you are. Yeah. What else?
And one was like the risk exposure, like the kiruv batin.
Yeah, good. Kiruv batin. Did anybody get up to that? How at risk are you? So the idea is if you're closer to an enemy city, then you benefit more from the protection of the wall and the police department than somebody who lies in the heart of the city far away from the enemies. Everybody remember that? Yeah? Yes or no? So those are, so maybe you should distribute the tax based off almost the how much you're being helped by the services. Correct? These all sound reasonable? What else did we see? Josh?
I was just asking, based on pure bias, meaning if you don't want to use a library and you're not going to use it at all, then you wouldn't have to pay anything for the libraries?
We'll see. So what we don't know about low plugs and things like that. Let's just get the general... you know, Zolti had a piece of the library, he wouldn't let anybody else in. Just to keep all the books for himself. Right. What else do we find in our Gemara along these lines? As you see in terms of distributing the tax?
Someone has a shkacha pratis, someone has a rabbanon.
Yeah. Going to have to figure out what's going on there. The rabbanon lo bayin etirusa, how the chachamim are exempt from taxation because they don't benefit. I guess that's similar to the kiribatim thing. Very controversial type of argument. But the thought is maybe some people are exempt from the taxes. These are all questions about how to distribute the tax on people. And then I want to get back to Josh's point, so we can call this a third issue, which is how does this question about how we distribute the tax give us insight into this question, which is the legitimacy of taxation in the first place. So what might that mean? What's a way where this question might shed light on this question? Ezra?
Some sort of fairness doctrine.
Right, exactly. So if the thought here is that if we could see based on how the tax is distributed that it's tailored or allocated based on how much you benefit, then maybe there really is a Yorid type justification that legitimizes the tax, right? You're paying because you benefit. Or maybe there's some other, maybe the way it's distributed will reflect some other justification for why the for why it's okay to tax people. Okay? Romy?
What's the third? I don't understand the third issue that you're reading there.
How does this question, the way the tax is distributed, shed light on what legitimize the content of what it is that legitimizes the tax in the first place?
You said the first question is what is whether or not taxing is legitimate.
Yeah, or, yeah, what legitimizes it?
What? Isn't that the same
with
the third question then?
Yeah, but the third one is just saying we're going to look. It's an agenda. We're going to look at.
Okay.
Can we look at how the tax is distributed to shed light on question number one? So does two give insight into one? Rami, you okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everybody good with the agenda? Now. I want to take a moment just to reflect further on number one, and that is, do we think that we need to legitimize a tax in the first place? Do we need to be thinking about why is it okay for the government to tax us? And just to be explicit, let's look at the Mishnah for a second, and then I want to pursue this inquiry a bit further. Somebody just read this Mishnah for us, Josh. You want to read the Mishnah for us?
Yeah.
So one second. So who's being compelled to build this?
So this guy is not necessarily directly benefiting from the Beishar, or he doesn't want to participate.
Right. So we have a guy, he lives in this courtyard. The members, I guess, decide that they want, or some people decide that they want to build a security fence around the private property or the common property. He doesn't want to chip in. What is the Mishnah rule?
So they could force him to chip in.
Good. They could force this guy to chip in for these public goods, for this common cost. Yes? So that's a chatzer. That's, let's say, like a condominium or an apartment building. Yeah? But then the Mishnah gives a different example. What's here? Josh? Yeah, so what's this, roughly?
So if there's a city that could wants to build a wall or some kind of other doorway. So they could also force him, and this guy doesn't want to do so, so they could also force him.
Yeah, so the same legal principle just expanded to city level.
Right.
You live in a city, the city wants to build a wall for its security protection. The city could compel individual constituents to chip in for that public good. So this Mishnah takes for granted that there is a halachic right to impose this tax on the constituents. Yes, Josh?
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think this Mishnah is limited to these particular public goods, Beishar, Delas, Chomad, Lasayim, and Briach? Or would you say the same thing would apply to a fire station?
Yeah, it's it applies to a fire station.
Yeah, I agree. Right? There's no reason to think that this Mishnah is a special din about walls and guard rails or guard, I don't know, fences. It seems to be a general principle about the public goods required for a community, which is what taxation is usually about. Standard taxation, right? Fire department, roads, garbage disposal, a military to protect you, things like that. Agreed? Yeah? Yes, yes?
Yes.
Anybody opposed? Okay, and if you look at the Tosefta, Josh, we're not recognizing your opposition yet. We'll get to you in a second. And if you look at the Tosefta that we'll see later on, the Tosefta expands this, you know, for digging a well, that the people need water, so a plumbing system, a sewage system. Those things are explicit in Tosefta when it talks about the powers that the B'nai Ayir have. Let me see. We'll get to Tosefta in a minute, but Tosefta is explicit on that front. So just as a halachic matter, it seems from this mission on the Tosefta and Rav Metzia that, of course, there's a right to tax. The mission doesn't give us any insight into what the basis for that is, but the right is there. So it's uncontroversial halachically. And Josh, even Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, who maybe disagrees on some level with the Chachamim's view, do you think he disagrees with the legitimacy of the tax, or he's just saying that? How do you read Rav Shimon ben Gamliel?
I think he's saying it's not always appropriate to tax. Like, there are cases where there's no need for a wall, there's no need for a base shar. In those cases, it doesn't.
Yeah, but let's say there is a need.
He agrees fundamentally that taxation is legitimate.
Yeah, exactly. For necessary goods, at least. But he's pointing out that sometimes goods are not necessary. Right?
Yeah.
Good. Dov, you have a hand on this?
I was going to say that he says it needs to be a necessary good, which you said so.
Ah, good, yes. Very interesting question. Maybe this gets to Zolti's point. You know, what exactly is necessary and what's not necessary? Maybe Rav Shimon Gamliel and Chachamim disagree about how necessary it has to be. Right, Joe, that's the point you're making?
Yeah.
Good. Josh?
Yeah, I would just say that, the Chachamim also, if you want to read that, it's these things, Dafka, also say that has to be necessary. They're not talking about building public schools. They're talking about, securing the town from being overrun by bandits.
Yeah, good. So it's a good question about the scope of this, right? We have to ask, what's the scope of, necessary public goods? Which is what you guys are raising. And here we don't know yet. The Mishnah only gives us a few cases, but at least security is up here. And when we look at the Tosefta, we'll see what the Tosefta includes. Okay. Now, I'm going to come back to this Ramban, the Ramban and Asisa Geshavat Tov later on. But some of the Achronim here, Kovei Shirim among them, what does he do? What inquiry does he pursue? Before you tell me exactly, what questions he posed, what's the type of inquiry that he raises? Rami? Yeah. Why is this rule, on what basis is the rule in the Mishnah of imposing the tax on the B'nai Ha'ir and the B'nai Ha'chatzer? They're legitimate. And he starts searching. He says, is this Tzarachian? Me'ezetam, so Romy, read this for us.
Me'ezetam Yitzayev Lissala Kezek Asirim Asher Hu Inu Gorin Dizeh. V'had Kov Na'il L'Chloma Efter Dach Tegudit Tekanatam. Meaning his question is how is possible.
Yeah, so he's saying, wait, the rule. Right, maybe it's a Tekanas Chachamim. But then he says, wait a second, it's strange to think. Yeah,
go.
Right, it's like, oh, for a chatzer, it's kind of strange to think of this takanas chachamim, that if you live in an apartment building, you have to chip in for the delas. So he balks at that. And then he throws another possibility out. Right. So what's the normative basis for having to pay taxation on the second view? It's the minhag. And we saw, kol k'minhag ha-medina. So maybe it's only because it's the minhag in town that you have to chip in. If it's the minhag to pay taxes, then you have to pay taxes. And if it's the minhag to cheat on your taxes or whatever, then whatever the minhag is. Right? That's usually what he's saying here. And then he balks on that. Right, he's like, oh, I don't really know. Like, why would you have a halakhic duty to follow minhag? Okay, and then he goes and he says, oh, well, maybe in one case. It's like an implied understanding when you get together.
Like, when you join the city, so you agree to what we use, our standards.
Yeah, or it's implied that you're being mechayev yourself for certain things.
Right.
But then he has.
The ship that doesn't work. The ship that I use, the shay, it doesn't work if you didn't buy
anything. Yeah, right. If you just received it as an inheritance, then it's not obvious that you were mechayev yourself to chip in. It's not Zabashah, right. I mean, if you read Locke, remember Locke in the Second Treatise? I think he says something like, if you inherit land, when you take possession of that land, you're agreeing to all the liabilities and costs that come with being a landowner, right? But Rabbi Elchanan here, I think, more interesting to us right now than his particular suggestions, takanas chachamim, minhag, imply hischaivus. I think it's just fascinating that he's like trying to understand what the halakhic basis is for the B'nai Ha'ir having a power to raise taxes, to impose taxes. Does everybody see that? And that assumes that we need to find a basis for we have to legitimize the imposition of costs on the individuals. Okay? Do you guys think that Rabbi Elchanan's right to take that for granted?
Yeah, I think it's a very reasonable question to ask. I think it's kind of the fact that it's up to the throwing taxes and didn't like help in the Mishnah or Gemara is kind of surprising. Like, people have property, you can only take it away if there's some legal basis.
Ah,
and so any taking away of property requires, you know, strong justification.
Yeah. So Zachari here is a good I would say a good property rights guy. And Zachariah is saying, well, if you're taking away people's property, it needs justification. And that's what Rabbi Elchanan is trying to do. What justifies the B'nai Ha'ir taking away your property?
Yeah, it's certainly not move on me a lot. That's like a lot of halacha doesn't work this way.
Okay. Anybody want to offer a counter suggestion to Zachariah's point? Josh?
I mean, I think like you said, you can say that maybe we don't recognize such strict property rights in that way. I mean,
right.
Maybe it's not really true that you own this property so much that we need such a justification to take away some of it. Who says that you really own the property in that way?
Yeah. Meaning, to put it in slightly different terms, but drawing off Josh's point, who says that, let's say, the Mishnayos that establish kinyanim and property later on in Bava Basra, wherever they are in Kiddushin, are more fundamental than the Mishnayos in the first parak of Bava Basra, which establishes that the B'nai Ha'ir have a power to be kofeyu, to live in those Beishar V'delas, etc. Meaning, the Gemara talks about different concepts. There's one concept of property, there's another concept of taxation. I don't know which one of those is more fundamental, such that the other one is infringing on it. Maybe Adrabah, maybe your right to property has to be justified in light of the fact that it's restricting the B'nai Ha'ir's authority to take it from you. Maybe. See what I'm saying? Or is that not a good response?
Josh,
that's what you're getting at?
I mean, it was better put than...
It's my job. No, but I think that's the spirit of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like we have a lot of evidence that we give a lot of power to individual property rights. We have B'nai Ha'ir, we have Gazeba, right? We have these Kinyan. I think it's just like, just in terms of quantity, there's a lot more talk about individuals
So you're making an argument about what Shas spends more time discussing?
Not just Shas, I think Michael. I think it's like much more, there's a lot of richer areas, a lot of serious prohibitions.
Ah. So you would say that, you know, as between Dine Mominis and Taros, Dine Mominis is more important because there's no Bavli on Taros.
It's not more important or less important.
It's more fundamental.
I mean, they're not in conflict. They're not in conflict here. There seems to be two different areas of Dine Mominis in conflict. That's a the area that's less fundamental or a little less grounded in Taros explanation.
Ah. So I would just push back and I would say, I don't know. I'm not as convinced that the length of discussion or treatment in the Bavli is evidences that it's a more fundamental din. Right, so it could be that maybe these few blot in Baba Basra, this Mishnah, and then we'll see Andaf Ches, Rashaim B'nei Ayir, maybe those are very foundational dinim that are more basic or have priority over the, you know, Mashicha, Agav, stuff like that, the property rights stuff. Rami, you have a thought on
that? Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not such a stira, because you're not saying that those property rights don't exist, you're just saying, it's kind of like, everything belongs to God, you don't own all this stuff, in the system that we live in, you get to, you know, keep this stuff, and people taking it from you is problematic, and we do have rules and like about that, but if there are these other values that Hashem, you know, Kalach, or whatever he considers, then your ownership doesn't take, you know, doesn't set in the first place.
The Eov of arguments, like, Hashem Hassan, Hashem Lakach, you know, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, not just that, not just that.
I know that's like a strong
But more than that, you know, Rav Yehuda gave a very good example in his Sichas Maser, that tour in Hilchos Tzedakah. You know, don't say, Eich Echzar Mi Mamoni. How could I lose my money to give it to you? It's, oh, it's just the pikadon bershuska. The Borei Olam says, give it to somebody else. And so actually, when you say, you know, all these sugyas talk about property rights, and there's only this little daf here in Baba Basra, you know, tzedakah might be part of this discussion also. So that's part of what we're actually going to see. So the point that I want to make is that the Achronim, the Rabbi Chanan here, enters into this inquiry to figure out, how is it that the Mishnah on Daf Zayin is justified in saying Kofinos Olivinos Chomad Losayim of Riach? That is, he's assuming that it needs justification, and that there's something more fundamental than this Mishnah out there that's being overridden. And my point is that that's it's not clear that he's right on that front. Does everybody see that? You understand where I'm coming from, Benji? Good.
Yep.
Okay. Zolti.
Yeah, so even according to Josh's approach, you still have to draw the line somewhere where you're going to say that you just don't forego property rights for the sake of, you know, the Hatzer. It's still going to be that line drawn at some point, in which case you don't have to explain, though, why you're legitimizing that. I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to have to legitimize the reason, which is the reasoning why they can't just take whatever they want.
Why can't they take whatever they want?
Yeah, at a certain point, like, there's going to be a line.
Maybe they could take whatever they want.
At any point.
Maybe.
So you're going to be like under the assumption that, like, I can just take your house even though you're using it.
Yeah.
And that's not a place.
Well, it depends who you are. Are you the B'nai Ayir or are you your individual?
B'nai Ayir.
Right. Maybe they could. It's like a government taking. Maybe the government could take whatever property they want under eminent
there's
domain.
There's no line. There's always going to be.
No line. Maybe. Is that a halachic impossibility to your mind?
It's a very, very extreme situation.
The halacha tends to be extreme at times. No? Yahargal Yavor. This is less extreme than that. No?
I'd say, I don't know. This
says, Yesh, you know, Mamono Chaviv Alav Migufa. Maybe this is more extreme.
I don't know, maybe.
We're going to see the Tosefta. I think the way when we read the Tosefta based off the Brice and Daf Ches, the Tosefta seems to say, yeah, the B'nai Ayir could decide that all property in the town is public. I think that Tosefta says that. Which is exactly the extreme case that you think the halacha wouldn't recognize. So the Sigin Daf Zayin and the Sigin Daf Ches go hand in hand. So this is one of the questions we want to see. How far does the halacha go in giving the B'nai Ayir power over individuals' stuff? Yeah. Okay. Everybody good so far? Now, the Kovet Shirim in the next simin in Os Mem Aleph, he continues his inquiry. In Os Mem, which we just read, he can't find a clear basis for this right of the Bnei Ha'ir to tax. So what does he suggest in Os Mem Aleph? Romy, you're reading it for us?
Yeah.
You can just read this part. Well, what's the argument? Tell us the argument, then you could classify it.
Okay. The argument is basically that you don't lose out and you actually benefit from, this obligation.
Yeah, the improvement.
Yeah.
So a very, very cute argument. His thought is that maybe the reason why the condo board could tax you is because it increases your property value. So a property with a door or with a security fence, it increases the value of all the individual units, so that you're chipping in to the cost actually puts you in the net positive. So if you were to sell it, you'd gain more, and or at least you're not losing. Is that his formulation? Nitsa shelo chaser. At least you're not losing, and that's why it's halachically legitimate. So he seems to be assuming that were this tax to create a net negative effect on you individually, the Bnei HaChatzer would not have the authority to do it. It's only in those cases when you're at least at a net, you're net neutral, and everybody else is going to gain, that they have the power to do so. And it's a kofin al midas tom, we have the authority to compel you to act in a manner that benefits everybody else, so long as you're not losing. What do you guys think of that argument? Josh? Benji?
I think you run into certain issues like paying for the elevator if you live on the ground floor.
Yes.
So, it's not improving the value of your unit at all.
Right. So it's actually a very controversial argument because it's actually not obvious that every individual is at least a net neutral, where it is not losing when they have to chip in for these costs. So I think it's actually really empirically inadequate type of argument. I agree with Benji. Right? Josh? Yeah. Zolti, you agree?
Yeah.
Josh, you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. Shmuel?
I do agree that maybe the problematic in terms of an efficiency standpoint, who says I can't be more efficient with raising property or the money I would spend? I think over time, though, yes, if you're on the ground floor, you're getting less benefit, but if you're on the top floor, you're getting more. And if you're on the ground floor, then maybe you get more of a security system because a robber will go.
It all balances out.
It'll balance out over time.
So the system of taxation balances out overall.
Right, but there could be an inefficiency argument. I don't think it's a terrible argument, but not the rule.
Yeah. What?
It's one of you can use a veiled ignorance argument. Sometimes you're poor, sometimes you're rich, and you're rich, okay, you're not benefiting from the system, but you want it to be such that, if you or your sense of
poor, yeah, as a general thing, maybe that's a good argument, but that's not what Rabbi Hanan's going for here. Right? Rabbi Hanan's saying, it sounds like he's saying in any particular case, the basis is kofen al midas tom, not sort of like a Shmuel saying, not knowing which floor of the apartment building you're going to land on, you gain by this rule. That's not the sense I get from Bochanan here. He says it's ain hefsed mamon. There's no hefsed mamon in any particular case. But this is all consistent with his approach, thinking that we have to justify the ability of the Bnei Ha'ir and the Bnei HaChatzer to raise these funds. Okay? Josh?
We're giving this such a problem because, in my mind, this is basically what we were talking about, in Dinei Shvi'im, in the first couple of sigas, huh?
Yeah.
Not that different than what we've been talking about.
Rabbi Hanan's point, or the...
This idea of, Dinei Shvi'im, it's helping both of you out, therefore we're going to get... It's what we've been talking about the whole year, huh?
Yeah, so I agree with that. That's why it's in the first paragraph of Basra, I think. Good. I think that's the way the Nesivis formulates it. But notice how Rabbi Hanan really just, he shoots everywhere. He says, oh, maybe it's a takanas chachamim that they could tax you. Maybe it's a minhag basis that they could tax you. Maybe it's an implied hischaivus, which we saw is how some achronim conceptualized shchenim. Right, Josh? Implied hischaivus. Maybe it's kofen amidas tom, where we have to assume that you're not mafsid at all. And I think there's a way of understanding shchenim which is distinct from all of these. From what he's saying. Like, I don't know that everybody would say in every shchenim case
that you need a benefit.
You're at least a eino chaser b'kach. Good. Any comments? Harry, you had a comment? Or okay. The Nesivus in Simen Kuf Hayin Ches Sivkat and Gimel is discussing a case of Shutvin, similar to the case we saw on Tuesday of Hanu Beitre de Dairi Ilai Vitatai. The guy is living upstairs and the guy is living downstairs. So it's a very narrow case of two people, not a Chatzer or the Rabim. And he's trying to figure out if the house falls down, could they compel each other to rebuild? So it's like the Surfside, and that's the name, that condominium that fell down. So can they compel each other to rebuild? And the Nesivus says, yes, you can. What's the basis? He says, he thinks it's halachically obvious that you could compel the other members, or if it's just two people, you could compel the other partner to rebuild. On what halachic basis could you compel them to rebuild? So look what he says. Afilu shnayim shein on shutvin. Who had a chance to prepare the Nesivus? Josh, did you have a chance to prepare it? Not there yet?
We skipped it, because Ro, me, and Kobe were doing it also. We sit right next to each other, so we can't be the same source at the same time.
Oh, is that the rule?
It's like the bad, but it's too distracting.
I hear that. Eitan? Louder.
So two are partners. So if there's something which both require, then I thought say less so if one of them doesn't want to do it, the other person gets to put it. So the second person can force him to do it.
Yeah, by the way, the Nesivus is in general is chock full of just creating these halakhic principles, articulating them when they're not articulated elsewhere. And here's one of them. He's like, oh, here's a general halachic rule. What's the general halachic rule, Eitan?
That you can force someone to build with you if he doesn't want to build.
Notice he doesn't even talk about building here. Just look at the phrase again.
He's required something for himself. And then,
well, translate to kol sheyesh davar.
So if there's anything.
Sure.
Which requires both.
No. Shehu mukhrach l'shnehem. Maimonides graduate, right?
Yeah.
Take a stab at it again. Ve'ena achad rotza. Sorry. Shehu mukhrach l'shnehem. You first translate as what?
He is required
both. What?
He needs both.
What do you mean he needs both?
Like he needs the other guy to build for him to be able to build as well.
No. Shehu. Yeah, it's. That it is. Required lishneihem. What's lishneihem?
Both of them. For both of it or both of them.
Try it again. Kol davar shehu mukhrach lishneihem.
Anything which requires both parties.
Mukhrach lishneihem. It's the lamed. What's the...
Two.
Well?
Two.
Yeah, so... Try it. Take another stab at it. Hold up our show. Machach l'shneim. This is why my daughter hates me. It's like a chayisara, where you know every pasuk, it's the. Yeah. She's always adding in like hayes as a definite article. I'm like, where does that hay come from? And then she's like skipping over to
Chilia. How old is your daughter?
She's 8. It's not. She's pretty old. I mean.
What?
Yeah, you gotta drill the dikduk in, otherwise you don't have it. Yeah, I'm suffering from not having had dikduk drilled into me when I was younger. Are you done? Wanna?
Anything which it requires to
both of us. Sheshehu mukhrach l'shneihem. Anybody wanna help Eitan out? Rami?
They both need it?
Yeah, that is necessary for both of them. Mm-hmm. Make sense? Eitan? Meaning that they both require it. So it is necessary to both of them. So not that it requires both of them. I mean, it's a joint basic need for the two of them. Now, some of you guys will say, well, what's considered mukhraf l'shneihem? Is a library mukhraf l'shneihem? That needs to be cashed out. What is mukhraf l'shneihem? But anything that is necessary for both of them. Go ahead, Eitan.
And one doesn't want to do it, then the other is important.
Exactly. That's a really broad principle. Anything that both people require and one of them doesn't want to do it, you have the legal power to force him to contribute to it. What a remarkable rule. Right? So, see that taxation is as simple as that. Anything that you require, you don't want to chip in for it, so we could compel you to chip in to achieve it. If you have military, if you need security, if you need fire protection, right? If you need, what else? Water, plumbing, education. I don't know, is education mukhraf l'shneihem? Healthcare. Whatever you think is mukhraf l'shneihem, the Nesivos thinks, oh yeah, you could compel somebody to chip in for that. Very, very broad, wide-ranging principle. And then what's the bit? Where does he get this halachic principle from? Where in halacha does it say this? Eitan? Exactly, and Bechain. Yeah, the Bnei Amavoy, the Bnei Chatzer, the Bnei Yir, they could all compel each other to pay for the security. So the Nesiva says, this is the Makar in Halacha, that there's just this broad, wide-ranging power that we have against others to compel them to chip in for the things that are required. So a public good, that's a public good that's necessary for all of us, we could force everybody to chip in. I don't know, is that a Yorei theory, Benji? I don't know, would you say that's a Yorei theory or a separate theory? I would say it's even a separate theory. But he's saying the makar for it is this Mishnah on Dav Zayin in Baba Basra, a very understated makar. And he's hanging this huge principle on our Mishnah. Josh?
I feel like I might be asking dumb questions. So, like, let's say the guy's an ex-Marine and he sleeps with a shotgun under his pillow. Like, are we saying he needs security so he has to have security? Or no, if he sleeps with a shotgun under his pillow, now he doesn't need it, the wall anymore, because he's got on his own.
Yeah, so that's a good question about what's considered mukhraf l'shneihem, and what if you have, right, you have a fire extinguisher in your house.
Yeah.
Yeah, and who gets to decide what's mukhraf l'shneihem? Right, so I think when the rubber hits the road there, it could get complicated to figure this out. But that's not a problem for the principle itself. That's how do we apply the principle.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry.
Also think notable, like the first four words of that phrase. Afilu b'shnayim she'ein an shusha.
Yeah.
I think he's explicitly going against one of the Kovach Yoram's suggestion that, oh, there's some sort of, you know, implicit Tanai that's coming on here. There's a pre-existing framework of partnership. It's like, no, even if there's no pre-existing framework of partnership.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. That, I should bold it. The afilu b'shnayim she'ein an shutfin here is very important. So if it doesn't require any antecedent relationship between the two people. Right? So the thought is you're walking in the midbar and you meet somebody there and you both need water and it takes two people to get the water out of the bar, you have a legal right to force the other person to comply with you. Right, Zacharia?
Yeah.
Very good point. Ezra, did you have a hand?
I was going to say more like, it seems something that's like very vague, and that, what's, like, maybe I'll explain it a bit, like, it seems like more of the shenanigans seems like it could depend a lot on, like, who gets to define that.
That's like Josh's, that's consistent with Josh's question.
Oh, but I was more talking about not meaning for like the individual more.
Right, what goods are mukhraf l'shneihem?
Meaning, for instance, like they're talking about like walls and stuff, but like, who's to say that it's not important to have, say, a city-funded garrison?
A jail.
Guards.
Oh,
guards.
Like soldiers.
Yeah, like who would say it's not important to have...
Like a draft.
Yeah, draft. Some might say it's more important to have a draft. Some might say it's more important to have physical defenses, and also maybe not necessarily from a security perspective.
That's okay. So that's just a question of who gets to decide. But whatever it is that's mukhrach l'shneim would fall under this halachic rule. Right? So you know, maybe political philosophers try to argue about what are the basic goods that are necessary for everyone. And then we would try to figure out. We would insert that into this kol davar shehu mukhrach l'shneim. Yeah. But I agree. At the level of application, it would take a lot of thought to figure out what those goods are. Yeah. Oh, and of course, at the borders, at the gray area, people would disagree, would debate. Healthcare, I don't know, education, I don't know, etc. Okay. So then he says, again, Uvedavar hamukhrach l'shneihem. Hey, Tanya, you're reading for us?
Yeah, Uvedavar hamukhrach l'shneihem, b'emet kofin zeh.
Okay, and he cites a Tosefta. This is a Tosefta, one of the Tosefta's I was referring to, b'metziah perek yud aleph. Go for it, Eitan. Yes, they could even compel each other to create these like, irrigation ditches. Alma.
So one person can't do it on his own. So the second part is also fixed. The other guy is forced to get his part.
Yeah, good. And here Josh could ask, well, V'yefshar la'achad l'takin la'atmo. So, like, what if everyone could sleep with a shotgun under their pillow? Is that after the talking of the atmo? So it's an interesting question. What could you do on your own? But I think there are some things that we agree that you can't really do on your own, right? Probably none of us could keep China's nuclear arsenal at bay on our own. Except for Zolti, if he's the only literate person in the country. He's going to take care of it. But, you know, those are things that you can't be talking on your own. So then you have this right to compel others. And again, he quotes the Shulchan Aruch Kuf Samach Aleph, Chamesh Chatzeros HaShov Chos Mayim Lebib. Water, you know, a sewage is something that you need. It's a collective action, public good. So you could always compel people to chip in. Notice he doesn't say anything really here about Nene. He just talks about what's Mukhrach La'atzma, what's required. I don't know if everything that's required, do you benefit? Are you considered to be benefiting from everything that's necessary for you? I don't know. You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah? I want to think about that. So maybe you could say that you're paying for the benefit, but I'm not sure you have to lean into that justification. And then he applies this to a case of two people again. So Eitan just finished it for us. Right, so it's like zoned exclusively for this type of building, let's say, in our paradigm. Yeah, under that theory that anything that requires two people that you can't do on your own, you could compel somebody else to do it. Great. So I just want to point out how the Nesivis seems... How do you think the Nesivis relates to the Kovit Shiurim? Conceptually. Sorry?
It seems like he's working from the other direction. So he's treating Kofen B'nai Adir as like the conceptual primitive and then you can build things on top of that.
Yeah.
While the Kofen Shurim says, okay, this is some sort of consequence, let's figure out what's behind that.
Yeah, exactly. Does everybody see that? The Kofen Shurim is saying, here's this strange Mishnah in Baba Basra or Daf Zayin. Let's try to figure out what explains what's the source for that Mishnah. And he searches in Takanas Chachamim, he searches in Minag, he searches in Midas Tom. The Nesivis goes the exact opposite way, and he says, this Mishnah in Baba Basra Daf Zayin is itself a fundamental principle that establishes this halachic rule. We don't need to look for a deeper source. This thing itself is the bedrock foundation of the halachic principle that you could compel somebody whenever something's a public good, that's necessary for both of them. Rami?
How do you see the Nesivis as assuming that, as opposed to just answering the question? Meaning, how do you know that the Nesivis is saying this is a fundamental thing, as opposed to saying he just doesn't spell out the question, he's answering the question?
So notice that the Nesivis thinks the principle emerges from the Mishnah, as opposed to the Rebbe Chanan, who's trying to explain what principle underlies or gives rise to the Mishnah. You see that difference? So pictorially, you have Mishnah and Zion of Viz, and the Kovet Shirin is trying to figure out what this Mishnah anchored in.
Good.
Yes? And the Nesivis, I should draw it on top of each other, and this would be easier if why you provided us with erasers. They don't. So, the Nesivis, you get a picture more like this. You have the Mishnah Dav Zayin, which anchors that principle of code. See that? So here, the point is that for the Nesivis, this Mishnah is the rule. It states a halachic, it embodies its own sui generis halachic principle. Whereas for the Kovet Shirin, no, this Mishnah has got to be explained in terms of some halachic rule that's articulated elsewhere. Kovet Amidah Stone, Kovet Amidina, Sakamim, those are all different things that can be placed into, those are different variables that can be placed into this box.
That kind of just looks like saying the same thing in two different ways. I don't know.
You think they're the same?
I mean, I understand how one could say, like, I understand conceptually, you could say either this is like the fundamental din or, you know, Kenyan and all that stuff, and then this has to be reconciled with that. But I don't know how you know whether or not you're saying
it. Kari, you want
to. Either questions applied or.
I would just say that I think the Kovet Shirin thinks that the rule, the Mishnah cannot sustain itself. There's a problem that needs
but
to be.
That's not true. If the Mishnah can't sustain itself, you just need to explain how it has been sustained.
Well, it's not sustaining itself. It's if it's sustained in terms of. Mina or Takana or. Kofin on the stone, right? That you could compel somebody without losing. So he's actually saying what explains this Mishnah is either this, this, or that. And then Nesivis is saying you don't need to explain the Mishnah. The Mishnah teaches us that people have the power to compel others to pay for public goods, for goods that are necessary.
You're saying the difference is whether or not you think that there needs to be some justification.
For the rule of the Mishnah.
If you think there's a new justification, if you think there's a new principle, I mean, because this concept is just made up here, therefore it's a fundamental principle. As opposed to needing to rely on some external thing.
Exactly. Meaning, the Kovet Shirin needs to rely on some external foundation. Like the Mishnah would fall off the cliff on its own. So it needs to be anchored into the cliff being halacha. What's that halacha that's anchored into? He throws a few possibilities around. And he would say, no, like, this Mishnah itself is like part of the bedrock. It doesn't need to be anchored in something else. It is the cliff. And what's the part of the cliff that, it's this new principle that teaches us when the Torah was given, it was said, also that Kofin Zez has its own sui generis principle. Just like Yishkip Shabbos, so Yishkip Shabbos, Zachar Zim Shabbos Takacho, and, by the way, if there's a public good out there, the cost is imposed on both parties. Make sense? Pardon?
We can probably get to it later in the year, but like Noah and I were on the Rebush, which literally brings it back to Matan Torah. So like the baseline premise of Matan Torah was that present generation can accept something for future generations, that these sort of communal stylists can work.
Uh-huh, that's interesting.
And therefore, these things come.
It's a very meta, right, very meta way of being, like, the fact
and
that.
How do we know that this is true? Well, it must be true because we accepted the Torah.
Right.
And that worked.
For future, so if the Yechidim or the Rabbim, we could bind others and we have this power over others.
Yeah.
It's an interesting point.
We saw last year.
Yeah. Well, I guess I think hopefully we'll discuss that too with Rivash when we talk about the Gemara Daf Ches.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Any Romy, we satisfied your okay, anybody still have Romy's concerns? Good. Kobe, we're good? Yeah? Great. Benji? Rafi? Great.
When no one read it, we just thought it was odd he was leaving out the justification, and this is sort of like an argument from absence.
It's Yula Shitasko. That the principle needs to be justified.
Yeah, as in,
but I think that's the beauty of the Nesivis, that he doesn't think it has to be justified.
But all it shows is whether or not you intuitively think taxation is legitimate. Right? I don't mean all.
Right, or is it in need of justification?
I mean, the only difference is, right.
And I think the beauty of the Nesivis point is that no, it's not in need of justification. It's a foundational halachic principle that, of course, Bnei Yair could impose their costs on their constituents.
Yeah, I guess it's a little confusing. It's not like Rav Tzan doesn't think that it's a legitimate halachic principle. He just thinks that you need to explain the legitimacy in terms of something else, which wouldn't take away from the power of the principle.
Except that his maskana is actually so tenuous. It's only legitimate in those cases where the person being taxed is not in a loss.
You're saying the scope is enough. I mean, like, if you find another principle, the scope is going to be much larger.
Yeah, especially in his maskana. Right? He's saying, it's only legitimate in these narrow cases. Yeah? Now, let me just say a little more to motivate this type of, what's the foundational halachic principle versus what has to be justified, what has to justify its existence. You know, sometimes in the Western society, we think that it needs to be legitimized because we think in terms of a social contract tradition, which is a story about the state of nature, where each individual appropriates stuff and owns stuff, and then at a later point, they agree to get together to create a state. So the collective social union always has to be justified in how it takes away things from the individuals who precede it. So that's why sometimes it's thought that the collective has to justify their authority over the individual. The point that I want to just bring out with this analysis today is that in halacha, you don't really have, we're not wedded to that story of how social power comes about. The Torah legislates its rules. And so the question is, within the rules of the Torah, which of these principles are more fundamental? The property rights principle or the Koach B'nei Yair principle? So even if you think because of your political commitments, one thing, just when you're not thinking halachically, when you're thinking halachically, it's not obvious that that same presumption should hold true. Is that super abstract? Is it a little too abstract for you?
Yeah.
Anybody grasp the point that I'm making? Josh, explain it in English.
Okay, basically, like, social contract theory is that we started out as individuals with rights, and now getting together as a collective people, you're always looking at what would you have had if you were an individual right, and now that we're looking at something different, we have to justify how we can be taking away what you would have been as an individual. The Torah doesn't have that havel, you know, it's not that we're looking back to when we're individuals, it's we're people and these are our rules.
Right, so the question is this rule, getting back to my exchange with Sakari earlier, which rule is more fundamental, the Kinyanim ownership rule or the Rasha B'nei Yair rule? Right, which one comes first? Are they on par? So it's not obvious, there's no obvious reason. Sakari was trying to give us a reason to think that the halacha treats one as more fundamental than the other, because maybe it spends more pages talking about it. And I was just saying that it's not obviously compelling. Yeah. Did Josh do a better job explaining it than I did? Yes?
No.
I like Josh.
Yeah. Hey, Josh, you did a great job.
Thank you.
Let's move now to our next main topic of discussion. So that was the broad hakdama I wanted to make about number one, about the legitimacy of taxation, the Rav Elchanan versus the Nesivis' way of thinking about it. Now I want to just quickly frame some questions of number two, which is, what's the fair way to distribute the tax? So we have just a comment in the Mishnah that already takes a stand on this. Let's see. Should I pick on Kobe? Why don't you read the last line of the Mishnah for us? Kami Yehe Bayir.
Kami Yehe Bihe Tanje Yer. Right? How much is like the city do?
Say it again?
How much time would we have some, because it's not just some time, but what do you have to do to be considered a Tanje Yer? Yud Bet Kodesh in 12 months. Or Kana Be Be Tira, right? Luka Anje Yemiya. If you buy a place, you immediately.
Good. So what's the Mishnah trying to figure out here?
Who is required to pay tax?
Yeah, which members or which constituents of the city are obligated to share these costs?
So distribution.
Yeah, exactly. It's the, you know, which how do we distribute the tax along the various stakeholders of the town? So the Mishnah assumes that you have to be a member in some way. What are the two criterion listed for membership?
So either you live there for a year or you buy a house.
Yeah. Good. So either purchasing a home or living there for 12 months. Does that sound reasonable? Yeah, I think it's reasonable.
Zoldi? Is that like rental? Is that what it's like?
The Yud Beis Chodesh thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're renting for 12 months, then you're now considered a member of a town. Okay? The Tosefta in Parakeet Aleph and Bav Metzia raises a different type of consideration. Kobe, you saw the Tosefta? So take us through this Tosefta.
Let's say you have a house in like some other country you don't live. Those other people who live in that country can force you to pay for a door and a bolt and a lock for the chatzer. But other things, they can't.
Yeah, so the idea here is you live in Manhattan, but you have a summer home in the Hamptons. Don't tell Rabbi Weider. And the question is, what can the people in the Hamptons tell you to do? What cost could they impose on you, given that you own a home there? Recognizing that you're not actually living there. Let's assume it's during the winter months. Okay. So what does the Tosefta say?
Seemingly just security things.
Yeah, delas minol lechatzer. So there's some things that they could charge you for, not others. It's not totally clear what exactly the line is or what's represented by the cases of delas nagar minol. Similarly for somebody who has a chatzer b'ir acheres. What does Tosefta say? Yeah, good. So, yeah, so if you don't live there, they could still force you to chip in for, let's say, sewage and running water, just to put it into our terms, and maybe for a collective bathhouse and stuff like that. Okay, but not for anything else. So why, how do we understand that distinction? So what are the things they could charge you for versus the things they can't? So how do you understand that distinction?
Meaning in which case?
So why are they allowed, what explains the things the town you're not living in is allowed to charge you for when you own a, so what explains the set of things the Hamptons is allowed to charge you for?
How much you own there?
Well, why are they allowed to charge you for those things? The Dell S, the...
It's beneficial for you, probably. For even if you're not there, it's going to be secure. And then for the water one, it's probably beneficial being, I think it's later on, it's like water is kind of the basic thing you need.
So how do you explain the rules? So what are the types of things that you have to pay for when you don't reside there?
Things that benefit you.
Everybody, that's Kobe's take. So Kobe's saying the distribution here, at least, is going to, whether or not you're obligated to participate will depend on Hana. Is that your point?
Just to clarify, benefit even when you're not there?
Yeah, okay. Benefit even when you're not there. That's the thought. How is that? So the Adar Mah here says, which I take it is your question, Zolti, right? How are you benefiting if you're not there? So what does the Adar Mah say? Anybody get a chance to see the Adar Mah? Zacharia?
He's saying...
it allows you to rent it out if it has security.
Yes.
That's the benefit you get.
Exactly. So the thought is that even if you're not residing in your Hamptons home, you could rent it out. Or you are renting it out. So the thought here is, Mi sheyesh lo chatzer b'ir acheres, mitayma delo mitgar le lebal habayis beise, ela hechi de avdi lo lechatzer delas v'nagaru mino. What's he saying? And similarly, velo mitgar le lebal achatzer chatzero, ela hecha de is be b'ir boro shichir maros v'amas hamayim, lemishti minai humaya. De ilo lo chazyo liyishov. So what's this argument here?
If it doesn't have the security or the water, it's simply not fit for inhabitants, and you won't be able to get anything from this. Therefore, this is just basically enabling you to use your property. Right?
Exactly. So the Adama's argument is that you need these goods, Beishar, Deles, Mayim, sewage, in order to rent out your home. So you benefit, even when you're not living there, by having the capacity to lease it out. Or to rent it out. So for all those things, for all the public goods that you could benefit, you benefit from, those are the ones that you have to pay for. So this is a almost an explicit way, as Kobe said, of linking the obligation to contribute to the tax to the kinds of benefits you derive from it. Rafi?
If you rent it out to someone for 12 months, then so that person now has to contribute because they've been there for 12 months, so they're taking care of it, but you're still benefiting from it.
Yes. Right? So I guess the question is, could they charge you twice, right? Charge you as the Baal HaBayis and then charge the... Sorry, could the town charge the resident and the owner?
Right.
Yeah. It's a good question. I don't know. Think about it. But yeah, it's a very interesting question. For like the Boro, Sheikh, and Amaros things, are both parties paying? Yeah, I'll look into that. Great. Any thoughts on this, Yadarman? So I think you're right that, Kobe, exactly this brings us into the Hana camp. Skhari, you got a thought on
it? I thought it was interesting how he contrasts it with Eruv in the second little paragraph there.
Yeah.
He says, if you're not living in a mavoi, people can't force you to contribute to the Eruv, because it's not critical for renter. As in, you can probably find the renter even if there's no Eruv there.
Yeah, somebody doesn't, it's not somech an Eruv in general.
Right.
Maybe.
Right, go to Breuer's, you know.
Exactly. So you're not actually getting a hana from it.
Or it's not, I don't know, I kind of think it's not critical for you to receive hana.
Yeah.
I think the other one says, you simply will not be able to get anything from your property. This is enabling that.
Yeah. What does he say here in this paragraph? V'yamar lo nicha li me'egrayhu, v'lo b'tzarayhu, Dinahu dinachti b'nei maso b'nei chatzer v'agudel l'beis. It's a tricky halachic question. But let's hold off on that for now. I'm not going to get into that yet. Shmuel?
Just on Rafi's point.
Yeah, Rafi's point.
This is like fully on economics, from an economic standpoint.
Yeah.
Not from a life standpoint, but if it was going to be double charge, then you lose out on the benefit of the charge, the second charge, because the what call it you want, like the renter wouldn't be willing to pay for the cost of the taxes and the rent, like to track that, because there's the equilibrium price, so taxes affect that.
So you're saying there is some...
So you just lose out on that value, so therefore, people would say, oh, you are responsible for paying the...
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's an argument why you wouldn't get... the town wouldn't be allowed to charge both of them. But let's see if post-commanded, but I think that's a very fair type of argument. Josh?
Are we saying he's like grounding it and really it's because you're able to rent it out? Or like being able to rent it out is more of a siman, like the property's actually worth something?
Yeah. It's hard to know. Is it because you have the capacity to rent it out?
I think more of that, right? Like it doesn't really matter about.
Right. Okay. So you're net actually gaining the capacity to rent it out, like, as opposed to...
The property's worth something. Now.
Yeah. I think that's a fair way of reading this, for sure. But it's still trying to anchor it in the hana, right? So you're getting hana through having the capacity to rent it out. Right? It's now a valuable asset in virtue that it could create of its rent income capacity. Okay, now the Nesivus here has a comment. Let's see. also weighing in on this. So he's commenting in Kusim and Kufsam Chalef, where the Shulchan Aruch paskins is Tosefta, about when you're not living in the town, why do you have a duty to pay for... So the Yad Armah interpreted in terms of the Hanoi you get from, as Josh says, the capacity to rent it out. Has the Nesivis explained the benefit you get? Do I get a chance to see the Nesivis and Kufsam Chalef bays? Rome, you saw it?
Yeah.
Ratam, so what does he say?
Ratam there in the Beit Shar of Mitam has a Bria.
Right, so you're not obligated to pay for the Beit Shar when you don't live there. Why?
Because you don't have a
Bria. Meaning you don't suffer has a Bria, right? So it doesn't help you. Aval. So what's
But things that protect your home that you still benefit from.
Yeah.
That things that you still benefit from, like your house not being ransacked.
Exactly.
You still do.
Exactly. So you still benefit from the security that's provided for your home. Otherwise, Ganavim will come and literally take the stones of your house. People used to do that. My grandparents had a house in the Poconos that we go to sometimes. And I remember right after I got married, my wife and I went there. And it's like in the woods. So we got there late at night. And the house was broken into. And like someone had broken through the door. And they had gone around the house to see if they could cut out the copper piping. Because copper was very expensive. That's, I guess, a modern day equivalent of somebody would break in. What does he say? Sheyikhu haganavim chalonos, that they could like literally take the windows from the homes, v'yistur abayis, and take apart the bricks so that they could build it.
Did you say that time? Yeah.
Yeah. We ended up saying
there.
Yeah. That was before I. But that's the idea. The idea is that you benefit from your property being secured. Yeah, which I think is a reasonable type of hana. So even though you're not living there, you gain from the security to your property. Okay, so that again, these are both the Nesivis and the Yad Ramah are giving us a hana account for why you're chayiv to contribute to the Bnei Ha'ir in a town that you don't live in, but that you have property in. Make sense? So imagine you have an apartment in Israel. But you live here in the States. So the thought is it's reasonable for you to have to pay property taxes in Israel because those property taxes go towards Israel securing, having a police force that could protect your property. Something like that. Okay. I want to make one quick comment here, and with this we'll close for today. Third point. This is really a separate, unrelated point to number two or to number one, but it is very helpful in just getting a sense of the type of right that the Mishnah is creating. So notice that the Shulchan Aruch says, he cites this halacha, Siman Kuf Samach Gimel, Dvarim Shebnei Ha'ir Kofin Zezeh, what could the town force you to chip in for rent? Afilu Miut Kofin Es HaMerubim. So that means, now let's say majority of the town does not want this, but a minority does. The minority has the right to compel the majority to pay these taxes. So that's a very fascinating qualification. You see the Gura also has this idea. So that's the Ramah standing up in Yerucham. And the Gura says, Kofen B'nai Yer Zezeh, Mashma Fil Yechidim. Because it doesn't say the Rabim could be Kofet. It sounds like even individually, if you don't have this power. And the Meiri is explicit about this. He says, "Af echad mehem kofes chavera bikach." So I just want to point out here that formulation is very important, or these halachic views are very important because it moves us away from a majoritarian conception of what's just. So the thought is that the ability to tax is not just what the majority thinks is right. Sometimes people think that democracy
is just a rule of the many. So literally whatever the most people decide is the just rule. The Rishonim here are saying that these rights are even minorities. It's even a person whose interests are against what the majority wants, he has the right to compel the majority to abide by this. Which suggests that the ability to have these goods, security, a wall in your town, here, so Choma, Delasayim, Livnos Lem, Besa Knesses, Liknos Sefer Torah Vimuksuvim, these are rights that the individuals have, regardless of what the prevailing desire of the community as a whole is. I just want to bring that out right now, and that's something we're going to come back to later. So this tension between the rule of the majority and the kind of intrinsic rights that individuals have, according to the Ramah and the Meiri, this is an intrinsic right that individuals have, and they could be kofa the rabbim. Okay, so that's a theme we're going to come back to. Okay, let's stop here. And I think we're not having shir on Sunday because of Hanukkah, according to the YU schedule, unless we want shir. You guys want shir on Sunday? Well, Josh, you want or you don't want?
Always.
Yes? Anybody second Josh's desire for shir on Sunday? No one seconds it. What? Great, that's fine. Whatever's better for the... I defer to the Rabbim. Sorry, no shir on Sunday. We have wedding Sunday morning. Anybody else want shir Sunday morning? I can have a chavrusa with Josh. It's fine. Just be the two of us. Okay, so next year is Tuesday unless we decide to change it. Let's assume Tuesday is next year. All right?